This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we start with our mouths, more specifically what we put into them when eating. And I promise this is not a judgy conversation. It is hopefully a really helpful one. Have you ever set a New Year's resolution to eat better and to improve your diet? You may well know then that it sounds simple enough on paper, but getting into the habit of eating healthier can seem really daunting when you start. So in today's edition of Be Well, which is our regular segment where we discuss ways to achieve wellness, we're going to demystify what it means to eat healthier. And we're also going to learn that you don't have to leave out your cultural foods or cultural heritage when doing so. So here to help us, two experts locally here. Joan Salgi-Blake is a clinical professor and dietetics internship director at Boston University's Sargent College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. And Kelly LeBlanc is the director of nutrition at Old Ways, which is a Boston-based nonprofit that aims to help people rediscover and embrace the healthy, sustainable joys of the old ways of shared cultural traditions through food. Joan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, so great to be here.
Great to have you. And Kelly, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
So, Joan, I'll start with you. What exactly does it mean to eat healthy?
Right. You know, eating healthy, we're looking at the diet in total. You're making sure that you have a wide variety of healthy foods. But, you know, I'm going to drill this down to make it easier for the listeners here. If you want to do one thing that's going to improve your health, and it's really going to get a lot of bang for each chew, is start adding more vegetables to your plate at every meal. You, by doing this alone, you are going to beef up the vitamins, the minerals, the fiber in your diet. You're going to beef up satiety because vegetables are full of fiber and water, so they fill you up before they fill you out. So that means you'll get full before you overconsume calories if weight management is an issue in the new year. The potassium in vegetables will help lower your blood pressure. I mean, there is so much bang for each gobble of vegetables. That's what one wants to can easily focus on and really do themselves good in the new year.
So Kelly LeBlanc, I'll bring you in here because I'm hearing Joan loud and clear. That makes perfect sense. You know, what immediately comes to my mind is, and we won't make this my personal therapy session here, right? But this subject is resonating with me. I don't want broccoli at breakfast. But one of the things that you do at Old Ways is look at the wide range of cultural practices in eating. So looking across the globe, what are some of the wonderful vegetables that get included in early day meals that we could think about for breakfast in our own kitchens?
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think when we look across the globe, there is so much inspiration. And if a certain vegetable resonates more with someone, then that's going to be a great place to start. So this could look a lot of different ways depending on where you are. In parts of Asia, you know, people have started the day with some very savory meals where things like mushrooms and spinach are right at home at the beginning of the day. Looking in other parts of the globe, in the Mediterranean, people maybe might start more with fruit. So there's a lot of different inspiration no matter where you are. But as Joan says, you know, getting that produce in at every meal, I think, is going to be key.
So, Joan, I'll come back to you here, and I'm going to collapse like 10 questions that I had for you into one kind of big question mark, which is, I am mindful that while we are having this conversation, there will be listeners who will say, I don't even know what's true anymore. One person tells me, don't eat any carbs. Another person says, eat grains. Another person says, you've got to be vegan. Another one says, I went paleo and I eat meat and nuts. The research seems to tell me on one day that a glass of wine is bad, and on another day, it's helpful to your heart. What is true, Joan, when it comes to understanding what is healthy?
You know, if you want to, like Kelly said, let's get on a boat, on a cruise, and let's travel to the Mediterranean, because the Mediterranean diet is science-based, and we know it is robust in produce, robust in grains, fish, healthy oils. tons of water. When you have wine, if you want, it's with meals, but in moderation. So we know that that is one of the best science-based diets that can help you do everything. And that is lower your blood pressure, lower your cholesterol, lower, reduce some weight. And again, I'm going to go back to that first thing I stated, because in the new year, people tend to want to make too many changes. If you could just get more vegetables, which is plentiful in the Mediterranean diet, on your plate. And the way to do that is to think about veggies first. So what you want to do is, we know that if you have a salad, a low-calorie salad, a lot of vegetables, a light dressing before a meal, or with the frigid temperature out there, a vegetable-based soup before the meal, we know that that will help you reduce the meal, the calories at that next meal by 10%. That is wild. Why? Because it's going to fill you up before you fill you out. It's going to give you all those vitamins and minerals that are good for the body. Most Americans are falling short on the recommended minimum 2 cups of vegetables a day. So I don't care if you slurp them. I don't care if you toss them. I don't care if you stir fry them. But think about getting them in. And what Kelly said is, if you grew up with black broccoli, Rob, if you grew up with kale, whatever your cultural vegetable was, just eat it.
So, Joan Salgi-Blake, I'm going to go back to Kelly in a minute on the Mediterranean diet. But while we're on this thread, it sounds like it's interesting, because I think our cultural practices are to begin with the main. And then you sort of say, what vegetable do I put with it? I think I'm hearing you say, start every meal by planting the vegetable and then build around that. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. And I'm even going to go one step further. Not only plan the meal around the vegetable, start it with the vegetable and start it with the salad first.
So the meal around the vegetable and eat the vegetable first.
First. So if you come to the table, you're hungry, you're ready to eat anything that's not moving because you're starving. So that's the when you want to appease that hunger with a lot of vegetables. So whether it's a warm vegetable soup with is like a blanket in your body, just cozy, or a tossed vegetable salad, eat that first. So that becomes the pace car. You'll get those vegetables in. You'll get them in for a lot of nutrients per bite, but not a lot of calories. And it'll help you set the stage and then go to the main. And the main should be, half of those plates should be produce. And then, about a quarter of it's supposed to be a protein source, which can be fish and can be beans. It can be any lean meat. And then the rest of it are going to be grains, mostly whole grains. And you start that pattern and you start that formula. It's veggies first. It's veggies first. It's veggies first. I'm telling you, this is going to be a very good year for you.
So we are talking with Joan Salgi-Blake and Kelly LeBlanc here on Radio Boston about, in our latest Be Well segment, about healthy eating, how one can do that without being overwhelmed, without being ashamed, and consistent with one's cultural heritage. So I'm really fascinated, Kelly LeBlanc of Old Ways, I'll come back to you, by the cultural heritage piece, because often in many cultures, as well as in our fat-conscious American society, we are shamed for the foods that we love. We are shamed for the things that, I have a little bit of sound here. This one just really resonates with me. This is from the 2010 film, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and you're going to hear actor Michael Cera and actress Mary Elizabeth Winstead here.
Garlic bread is my favorite food. I could honestly eat it for every meal, or just eat it all the time without even stopping.
You get fat.
No, why would I get fat?
Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
Right, so you can hear that sound, and we're all told, right? Like, I'm Italian, I'm missing my breads and pastas, but they've been permanently ruined for me, right? So you work on these pyramids. I'm looking at the African Heritage Diet Pyramid here. You have a Mediterranean diet pyramid, which Joan Salgi-Blake just told us the Mediterranean diet is a wonderful baseline. Help us understand. We've got the produce, we've got the vegetables first, they're the pace car, we've got grains. How do you build these pyramids that allow people to be true to what they've grown to love and also feed their bodies in a healthy way?
Yeah, so the first food pyramid, if you remember from a few decades ago, was developed in 1992. And so in at the time, you remember lots of bread at the bottom. It was very no-fat, low-fat in the 90s. That was the prevailing philosophy. And so Old Ways actually brought together nutrition experts from the Mediterranean who had studied the Mediterranean, including Ansel Keys himself. We had Walter Willett from the Harvard School of Public Health.
You say Ansel Keys himself. I have no idea who Ansel Keys is.
He was a nutrition researcher in the 50s and 60s who is credited with not discovering the Mediterranean diet, but really bringing it to the attention
of
the academic community.
Okay.
And so we worked with these experts to develop the Mediterranean diet pyramid. And we showcased, as you can see, produce at the bottom, lots of vegetables, as Joan has mentioned, and also olive oil and healthy fats. And, you know, from there, our work has really expanded. And so when we collaborated to create the African Heritage Diet Pyramid, for example.
Which I'm looking at right here.
Oh, wonderful. We brought together experts, including Dr. Jessica B. Harris, who you may recall from the Netflix series High on the Hog. And a number of different experts in not just nutrition, but also culinary history. So these are people who study these cuisines, who they themselves might descend from these different places to really speak to these healthy dietary patterns. And from there, you know, we've talked with Joan about kind of the road map of what a diet might be. But then when you look to your own culture, you are able to give the food its flavors that really celebrate your heritage.
So, for example, here, Kelly LeBlanc of Old Ways, I'm looking at the African Heritage Diet Pyramid, and then I'm looking at some recipes, some dishes from Western and Central Africa, African peanut soup. I'm not sure how to pronounce this, jollof rice with black-eyed peas, chicken yassa with brown rice. So, and some of this is available for the general population on your website, yes?
Yes, we have a number of recipes on our website, oldwayspt.org. But we have also been doing a community cooking and nutrition curriculum called A Taste of African Heritage. And that's been running for over a decade now. We celebrated 10 years last year, and it's been taught in over 100 cities around the country.
So, Joan Salgi-Blake, I'll come back to you for sort of the last question here. And what I've appreciated most, I think, is you giving everyone who's listening just a very simple place to start. Veggie forward, right? Just start veggie forward. Is there anything you tell people, not about what goes into their mouths or what's happening in their bodies, but what's happening in their heads as we start this healthy eating process?
Right. I want to tell you something. Yes. You know, stress is a trigger for people to eat. But we also know, getting back to the produce is actually very good for mental health. And we find that people who have more produce in the diet actually have less depression. So here we go again. And you're never going to go wrong with Mother Nature. And I want to tell you something. I am Italian also. In fact, I am 110% Italian. So that when you, I don't want you giving up your pasta, girlfriend. So this is what I'm going to recommend that you do. For every cup of al dente linguine that you have, you must always have a cup of vegetables. So in other words, going forward, always do your pasta in a one-to-one ratio. Cup of pasta, a cup of vegetables. If you want to go back for seconds, you can go back, but that seconds have got to be in the same ratio. So half a cup of pasta, half a cup of vegetables. You trust me, you do this. And what you're doing is you are using those vegetables as a pace car to fill you up and not fill you out.
All right, Joan Salgi-Blake, I do trust you. Clinical professor and dietetics internship director at Boston University's Sargent College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. Thank you to you.
Thank you.
And Kelly LeBlanc, who is the director of nutrition at Old Ways. And that website, again, is oldwayspt.org. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Do you have a mentor? Someone who shows or showed you how to move forward in school life, professional life, life, just in general? Or how about somebody you're mentoring? Today, we are looking at youth mentoring in Massachusetts. According to data from Mass Mentor, in 2022, more than 17,500 youth participated in mentoring relationships in the Commonwealth. Each one needs access to some kind of mentor. And therein lies a problem. More than one-third of the programs reporting to Mass Mentor have a waiting list. And data from 39 organizations put that list at over 2,300 kids, 2,300 kids, waiting for a mentor match. So why do so many kids want and need mentoring? And how can we fill that gap? Mark O'Donnell is president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts. And Pablo Gonzalez is a big brother in the program, with a boy named Dennis. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And Pablo, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
So, Mark, I'll start with you. Big Brothers Big Sisters is part of a national organization. Many of our listeners may be familiar with it over the years. But talk about your organization here in Eastern Massachusetts and what you do.
Yes, we've been around in Eastern Massachusetts for about 75 years. We're New England's largest youth mentoring agency. We serve, coming out of the pandemic, we're serving about 3,500 youth right now. We're on our way over the next 5 years, hopefully, to match 10,000 youth. And so we pair our kids one-to-one with caring relationship with mentors and just have, you know, guardians sign up their kids, just like you mentioned, because there's a need, a gap, there's something in life that is needed and some help, and they call us. We try to do our best to pair the same kind of, you know, kid with the same big, and they go off on their own, and they last, you know, we could talk about it today, they could last 20, 30 years. Like in Pablo's case, it's about 5 years. So it's a great, great situation.
So Pablo, you are a big, that's the term for a mentor, right?
Yes.
To a younger person. Your little is Dennis. Why did you want to be a big?
So when I first moved here to Boston, I came here with certain goals in mind, and I was, you know, spent a lot of time working towards those goals, going to school, working, and so on and so on. And once I sort of achieved those goals, I had a lot of free time in my hands. So in order to fill that time, I was looking for something to do. I knew I wanted to help, and somebody had recommended the program to me and said I should look into it. And, you know, I did some research online, and I decided to go in for an interview and talk it over with them. And over time, during that interview process, I found that it would be a good fit for me.
And it's a big commitment.
It is at the beginning. So it's all very, you know, it was a new experience for me. We sort of had, you know, it's 8 hours a month. We like to break them up in 4 hours on the weekends. And so it was initially trying to develop the relationship, trying to get it started. Once you're through that period where there's sort of like this, you know, feeling each other out, so to speak, it becomes very easy. You know, that's sort of one of the rewarding things about it.
What kind of activities do you and Dennis do?
So a wide range. I mean, he loves my dog. So a lot of dog walking is involved, going to parks and that sort of thing. We've also done a lot of the common Boston things, going to the aquarium, to the Science Museum, George Island. He'll just sometimes play video games at home. You know, if the weather's not all that great, we'll go to the movie theaters. So, you know, a wide range of things.
So, Mark O'Donnell, you're the CEO of the organization. Pablo's telling us about his relationship with Dennis. What I'm hearing is presence and time. So what is mentoring?
Well, mentoring is a lot of things for a lot of people. And, you know, I was just talking to Pablo in the back saying, 80% of the youth that are signed up for our program right now are coming with some kind of experience in their life, trauma, negative experience, and their guardian has noticed this. And so a mentor is someone who's not a clinician. It's, you know, we always say no experience necessary. Just be yourself. Bring yourself. Be willing to spend the time. And in Pablo's case, that is 8 hours. But we have other programs as well. We have some school-based programs. We have some programs that are called Mentor 2.0 that are after-school programs. So if you can't do the Saturdays twice a month, there are flexible ways to mentor a child.
So, Mark, take a second. I've run an organization before, mm-hmm. and you're telling us what the programs look like, what the organizations need, but I know that this is deeply personal
yes.
for you. What do kids need?
Kids need, at the most fundamental way, is someone to show up for them. That is the piece where there's not a whole village in their life or we wouldn't be needed. So a lot of cases, the guardian who is a savior, the mother, the grandparent, is someone they called because they care so much. but they're working. There might be multiple children. There's a lot of situations going on that are very hard for them and the world around them, right?
And they need a village.
They need a village. And this is the first step of creating that person. But take all the noise in the community and just having someone to know that on Saturday or at school, this person's coming just for me. And that alone is enough to build confidence and build some of those social-emotional skills that kids need.
So, Pablo, let's build on that. So what does it mean to you? I mean, every relationship is a two-way street. We're talking about how you're showing up for Dennis. I'm sure Dennis fills, you know, your cup, too. What does it mean for you to be part of Dennis's village?
So in Dennis's case, as well as my case growing up, we both live in a single-parent household.
So you did, too.
So I did as well. So that is something I know a lot about. And to me, it's like you just said, it's very important for somebody to show up for you. It really is. It really does make a difference. And I see it in him when I do show up, right? I don't feel like it's ever forced. I don't feel like it's ever I feel like he's happy to see me. And that alone is very gratifying. It does, you know. It does make you feel really good. It doesn't, you know, it feels like you're making a difference in somebody's life. And especially when you have the same experience he's going through and know what it feels like to not have somebody come, you know, show up for you. It really does make a difference.
So part of the way you can connect with Dennis is you understand a piece of his childhood because you lived it so deeply in yourself. You share language and culture with Dennis and his mom. Now, at one level, it's sort of like, yeah, that's obvious. Of course that makes a difference. But explain, give us an example, if you can, of how being able to be bilingual, to really connect in that way with Dennis and his family makes a difference.
Well, that was sort of an added bonus that I never saw coming. I eventually have become part of his family because I can communicate with his mother. I can sort of relate to what she's going through because I've sort of seen my mother go through it as well. And that's, you know, now I, you know, we're basically family. I get invited to his birthday party. She cooks for me, you know, it's like I said, that was not something I was expecting. So it does obviously form a much deeper connection when you can actually, you know, communicate with his mother and see what her concerns are and say, hey, what do you want? What would you like me to talk to Dennis about? You know, just throwing some stuff out there and so on.
So Mark O'Donnell, now we go to kids are waiting, right? There are kids who would like a mentor. There's a shortage of mentors. My understanding is there's a particular shortage of bilingual mentors.
True.
So what to do?
The waiting list, as you spoke about, could be in the thousands. And if we actually actively recruited youth, it could be 10,000. And one of the issues we don't want to have, a barrier we do not want, is for a youth to not be able to get a big because of language, because of geography, because of access to public transportation, and also male volunteers. There's a huge shortage nationally on men signing up. Women sign up about four times to every one man.
Why do you think that is?
They're just nicer people. I think we've done the research, and it is about language and how you speak to a man and the commitment issues that do arise. So it's all psychological. But what we did find is once matched, it's equally as enjoyable and equally as productive. So the outcomes are the same. It's just on that front end, it takes a little more work.
And what are the outcomes for the kids?
The outcomes right now, at first, you know, age matters. So from 7 to 11, it's the socio-emotional. It is the building blocks, the confidence, understanding school and life. And then when you reach 11 to 14, the outcome should be about how do I fit into this world? I'm in middle school. It was a hard time.
Very hard time.
And then when you reach, say you've been matched 10 years, you hit 16, 17. Now it's what am I going to be? And so the outcomes are stage specific, and we make sure that we're along the way keeping track of all that and making sure that they're gaining those skills to succeed.
And do you help the mentors be helpful in those stages as well?
That's the secret sauce, is every match is supported by a match support specialist from our office the entire time of the match.
So you have one, Pablo.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. No,
and so they are trained to work with the big, and once Pablo would come back and say, here are the two things I'm struggling with, Match Support will work that out, find the resources, or if he says, you know, we played video games two weekends in a row, we'll have a generous donor that will give us Celtics tickets, we'll offer that so they could go have some experiential experience. That's something we feel that Dennis needs. So the professional support is what makes us different from most mentoring agencies.
So, Pablo, I'll turn back to you for the last question. If there's a listener out there, a man, maybe a bilingual man, who's thinking, maybe I should try to be a mentor, mm-hmm. what would you say?
I was in the same exact position 4 to 5 years ago, and I'm really glad I went in and just did an interview. Just go in, do the interview, and see if it's for you, right? I never felt pressure to do this. I never felt like I had to or anything. Quite the contrary. The whole way through, it seemed like I was applying for a job, more or less, you know? So they're not – everybody wants you to be happy and the little to be happy as well. So it's just – that, just go for the interview and see how it goes.
And you're happy.
Oh, very.
Is it between your job, your personal life, this volunteering, is this one at the heart of who you are?
Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Pablo Gonzalez is a big brother to a boy named Dennis in the organization Big Brothers Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts. Mark O'Donnell is its president and CEO. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for giving us this platform.
And Pablo, thank you as well.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So we just heard from Mark and Pablo about the positive impact a man can have on a boy's life. And now let's talk about girls. Here's Justice Porter, who's a student at Jeremiah Burke High School. We had her on the show back in November when there was a spate of violence in the city and at her high school in Dorchester. And she talked to us, although not in specific words of mentoring, about the importance of mentoring.
I want to see a focus on the youth. So I think while people may think, oh, I'm paying attention to these teenagers and these kids, I don't think on a certain level that they really are, because us youth really have a hard time with the generational trauma and seeing the normalization of therapy and counseling it's not normalized, right? So I want to see more support in that aspect, more adults telling us, hey, it's okay to see a therapist. Hey, it's okay to reach out. And not make us feel like a burden or not make us feel like we're a bother, because we aren't. And if we don't interject and we're not saying, hey, you can feel this way to our youth, they're just going to keep that in again, and it's just going to repeat the cycle.
So a high school girl in our community talking about those needs. And here with us in the studio, Anissa Asaibi-George, to continue this conversation on youth mentoring. You may remember Anissa Asaibi-George as a candidate for the mayor of Boston, as a Boston city councilor. Well, now she's the president and CEO of Big Sister Boston. Anissa, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tiziana. I am also a former high school teacher. And when I hear Justice's comments about how important it is for adults in our community and beyond to be engaged in their lives every single day, I just want to jump out of my chair and cheer for her, because we all need to be cheering for our youth here across the city and beyond.
So it's interesting, Anissa, and part of the reason we wanted to talk to you to round out this conversation on youth mentoring is there's a lot of things you could have done when you left the city council and after the mayor's race. You picked this, and I think I just heard a little bit of why. But tell us more. Why did you pick mentoring for girls in Boston?
Well, first, Big Sister of Greater Boston, or Big Sister Boston for short, is all about our girls here in the city and beyond. Our motto is 100% invested in girls. And for me, it really is a continuation of public service. It's a continuation of giving back to the community and to the communities that I got to work with as a member of the city council in political life. It's an opportunity to continue service and making sure that I have opportunities to use my network, to use my skill set, to use those that I've built relationship with to serve our girls in Boston and beyond. Kids like Justice who need us every single day. Big Sister of Greater Boston, Big Brother, Big Sister, Eastern Mass, the national organization, we can do this work. It's so important to have the partnerships at the table to help us along. And that's part of why I'm here today.
So, you know, you heard us talk with Mark and Pablo about the village that a kid needs. And I hear in your cheering on of Justice, the high school junior at the Burke, you know, that sense of, I want to be a part of the village. Your teachers need to be a part of the village. You know, a mentoring program can. Is there a risk of an adult coming into a young person's life, into a kid's life, and becoming a mentor and then leaving. And, you know, it's the first do no harm. How do you think about that, Anissa?
Well, there absolutely is that risk. And that fear sometimes stops our adults from actually engaging and taking that risk themselves. We have another motto, another saying, or a hashtag that we use at Big Sister called Be Present, Not Perfect. And sometimes that fear of not being the perfect partner in that relationship limits an adult's ability to engage. We do an enormous amount of vetting, of interviewing, of education with our big sisters before we engage them or match them with their little so that we know they are the perfect fit. And as Mark referenced, there's lots of opportunities to get involved. We love, and at our core at Big Sister is that one-on-one mentoring, those relationships that we know will last for years and years beyond their actual engagement with us as an organization. But there's other ways to get involved. We have Big for a Day, which I'm a huge fan of. I've hosted that at the Stitch House, where we get to have lots of fun.
Stitch House is your business.
With my business, but we get to have lots of crafting fun with potential big sisters and potential little sisters as we start to explore potential relationships. It is not a lifetime of learning, but in many ways it is a lifetime of building relationship. And Big Sister is here to facilitate those relationships, to help guide and build those relationships, but really create a space in which a big and a little can form that long lasting, we hope life lasting relationship, which we know helps our young girls in particular. That's who we care about, that is center to our decision-making at Big Sister. It helps them be more confident. It helps them be more engaged in school. It helps them build for their future, make healthier life decisions. We know all of that happens, and we're happy to just simply facilitate those relationships.
We're talking about youth mentoring in the region in Massachusetts. With us now is Anissa Asaibi-George, who is the new president and CEO of Big Sister Boston. I remember having a town hall conversation with you at WBUR City Space where we talked a lot about your dad. This was when you were running for mayor. Who was a woman mentor in your life that you kind of carry with you as you're thinking about this work for girls in Boston?
So I've had the pleasure of so many mentors in my life, women mentors in my life, both those that held political office with me, those that worked alongside me in government or in my classroom, colleague teachers in particular, more veteran teachers who guided me in those early years in the classroom. But I actually, you know, certainly my mother and my grandmother in my life, we've had the opportunity to talk about them over the course of several campaigns. But my sisters, who are much younger than me, who have chosen a life of public service in their own way as a school guidance counselor and a school social worker, I think mentoring should be multi-generational. So although my sisters, for example, are younger than me, their experiences and the space that they've created really inform me in my work. And now at Big Sisters, I've got, you know, a staff of almost 45 new mentors. And although I'm the CEO and president, sort of the big boss, their passion and their work every day, especially over this last month, they've been mentors to me as I get into this new role. I do want to plug, when I talk about multi-generational mentoring, which Big Sister, it's a big part of what we do, although we don't scream it from the rooftops. We've got this New Girls Network. We've got an event coming up in March at PwC where we're pairing younger women early in their professional careers, who we want to partner with professional women who are a little bit further along in their careers. We want to create mentoring opportunities for them, too, because mentoring has to continue throughout the course of your life, both personally and professionally. We've got to keep it going. And I'm so grateful to have so many people in my life that help me along.
So you heard Mark O'Donnell talk about the shortage in mentors and also talking about the fact that women volunteer at a 4-to-1 ratio to men. Do you have a shortage of mentors for girls at Big Sisters Boston as well?
We always have a shortage. And it is around making sure that we don't just have one adult mentor, one big for one little, but that we have the right pairings that are happening. So there always has to be both littles and bigs in our pipeline. And the language piece that Mark and Pablo talked about is so critically important for our littles across the region. We talk about, you know, Spanish language. We see a growing population of Arabic-speaking families in our communities. We see a growing population of Vietnamese speakers across our communities, Portuguese speakers across our communities. If you speak a second language, if you've got time, just a little bit of time, I hope that you'll consider sharing it with us. We always look to grow the number of bigs who are available for our littles.
And give us the website. How can people find out more?
Super easy. BigSister.org. Not Big Sister, but BigSister.org.
BigSister.org. That's Anissa Asaibi George, former Boston City Councilor and the new president and CEO of Big Sister Boston. Good to see you, Anissa. Thanks for coming in. You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And we have another installment of Brilliant Boston, where we bring you into some of the most popular classes in our region's many universities. Last time, we took you to Harvard, to the Divinity School, for a class all about forgiveness. Professor Matthew Ichihashi Potts.
Part of what the course and my work tries to explore is, what is that moral space which allows us to still be angry or to still mistrust someone, but for us also say, like, I don't want any more violence. I want to move on.
The wonderful thing about having so many great universities in the region is classes come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And today we're going to Emerson College with a class that has a title that's a bit of a mouthful, Motivating Pro-Environmental Behavior to Save the World. It's a class that's kind of about putting a dollar value on culture, whether you can, why you might want to, and whether you should. Nejem Rahim teaches the class. He's with us now in Studio 2. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start with this idea that one might want to create a number, right?
Yeah.
To value a way of life or cultural practices or something that has cultural significance. Why want to do that in the first place?
Yeah, I know. It seems super counterintuitive. So there's a couple of reasons, but the kind of the place that it all comes from is that a lot of federal agencies and state agencies make decisions about projects, and private sector does this too, based on some form of a cost-benefit analysis, right? And so we've been doing this for about 100 years, where you take things like, obviously, the costs of building a dam or the costs of building a mall, and then, like, the benefits of doing that. It's like, that could be in lives saved, for instance. It could be in increased hydropower generation, right? So the thing is, all of these projects, all of these things that we do, they impact how people live. And the problem is that it's really hard to get that effect into the calculus that makes the decision about whether it's a good idea or not, right? So the idea of putting some kind of dollar value on a cultural impact of some kind or cultural practices is really just to make sure it's included in the discussion at the right level.
Okay, so that's super helpful. I think what you're saying is, listen, we evaluate what to do and not to do, often in some kind of business case, some kind of currency.
Yeah.
And so if you want to have a voice at the table where that's what's being done,
right,
then you have to figure out a way to do it that is thoughtful and respectful and appropriate.
Exactly.
And have you found in behavioral economics, and we're going to go to an example in just a minute, that it can be done in a way that is thoughtful and respectful and appropriate?
Yeah.
Or will there always be, I feel like I'm asking the obvious question, will there always be tension there?
There's always going to be tension. I mean, so part of the thing is that, so it would show up probably more in the field that we would call environmental economics or ecological economics, more so than behavioral. That's like a tiny little professional tweak, but
helpful.
Yeah. So I was doing some work for my dissertation. This is where I ran into it before when I was working up in Alaska, actually. That's probably a better case. So we were looking at the impact on an Inupiat Eskimo community called Kivalina, which has been in the news a lot lately because of climate change. But we're looking at the impact to local hunters there from a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer project to do this big, to dredge a harbor near the largest lead zinc mine in the world, right? And so this was going to create pollution in the water column in the Chukchi Sea, and that's going to affect how marine mammals migrate and feed along the coast. And you've got this Inupiat community that's been living there for a very, very, very long time. And
what does that mean? 10,000 years? 500 years?
Oh, so
give us a sense.
Yeah, considerably more than 500. Anywhere because they've been fairly migratory. So it's not like they've been specifically in that place, but probably somewhere between 8 and 11,000 years.
Okay. Very long time.
So yeah, really, 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 really long time. And so hunting whales, that would be beluga whales, bowhead whales, hunting seals, bearded seals, all the kinds of seals, catching fish, hunting caribou. This is essential and elementary to their understanding of who they are, right? In a way that I don't think we can really fully grasp in an urban environment. And so to impact their ability to hunt is to impact their sense of who they are as a culture, right? And so the Corps of Engineers did a benefit cost analysis to look at the benefit cost ratio of doing this project. And in their eyes, given their calculations, it came out to be a good idea. So what we were trying to demonstrate, my friend John Talberth and I, we were working on this project with another nonprofit. We were trying to point out that they had not taken into account the impact on the community. So to do that, we had to find a way to turn that impact into dollars, because those are the units that are used to make these decisions, which is crazy because that's not how anybody thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody thinks about it that way, right?
Right.
So, but the problem with that is then it gets left, as you point out, it just, they don't get to the table, right? So we did, we found a way to do that, and that was pretty effective. We actually managed to stop the project twice through the courts and through the National National Environmental Policy Act, right? So it's like a NEPA process, and there's a bunch of other federal laws that apply to this. But then I also did some work in northern New Mexico with irrigating communities, and I found out that it was way more complicated in that context. So now I'm doing work with folks out in Hawaii and American Samoa and Guam on looking at some of this stuff, and there are folks in the communities there who actually say, you cannot put a dollar, you cannot use dollars to evaluate this particular aspect of our culture. This one, sure. This one over here, absolutely not.
Meaning it's not measurable or it is offensive to try.
It's offensive to try.
So are you then, and let me backtrack. Okay, so
yeah,
we're
totally
speaking with Nejem Rahim. He is a professor at Emerson College. There is a popular class there on figuring out how to do these quantifications, whether you should, how hard it is. And it's interesting because when you said this is really about an environmental or ecological economics, that was the moment where I thought, oh, now I understand why it's such a popular class, because of the moment that we're in.
Right.
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 So are you also exploring how to bring something other than a number model to the table? And how do you make anyone understand or embrace something other than a number model?
Exactly.
If that's what's been 100 years, what gets brought to the table.
Exactly. So, you know, as you know, cultural change is always super difficult and super challenging, particularly when it's embedded in something like the U.S. government and in federal regulations, right? So I've been doing a bunch of work with folks from NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, right? So NOAA Sanctuaries is this part of the agency that runs marine sanctuaries. So like Stellwagen Bank, where you go, you know, whale watching here from the aquarium.
Right? Yeah. And actually, we have a segment on Stellwagen Bank. So I'll see if we can add it to our webpage for this conversation so people will have that for reference.
That's super cool. I actually taught a whole class on Stellwagen Bank. So I've been working with them to look to figure out how to answer this question, because they have to do these things called condition reports. And in the condition reports, they use a framework called ecosystem services. And that's a whole thing, but it's like the benefits that humans get from nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And very often the value of those ecosystem services are measured in dollars, not always. And there's a whole fight about that, right? So when we're looking at how do you measure the sort of status and trend of certain cultural practices, if you just say, like, they're doing pretty well with this, but other things are being measured in dollars, the danger is it might just, people might just, they don't count it, right? And so we're trying to find a way, and it's been really great working with these folks. We've been trying to find a way to how do you come up with a metric of any kind? Is it like, is it a narrative? Is it, I mean, some folks we've talked to have said, why can't it be a song? Why can't it be like images written on paper, because that might be how they would want to communicate it. But folks in the U.S. government, people in Congress, if you're asking to allocate funds to improve management in, you know, a big marine preserve in Hawaii, you got to convince someone in Congress that this is worth it. And if you're not telling them that in dollars, maybe it's hard for them to understand that concept. So it's incredibly challenging.
So that idea of bridging is an interesting one, too. And I want to get to a dam example in Massachusetts. But just briefly, you talked about the people in Kivalina in Alaska. One example, the Inupiat there, you referred to them as Inupiat Eskimos because that's what they told you they wanted.
Yeah.
And yet we know that in the broader conversation, some say you're not supposed to use the word Eskimo. Yeah. So it's this fidelity to the wants and needs of the local.
Exactly.
All right. So let's come to Massachusetts now. I'm going to give you a little sound here. WBUR reporter Walter Wolfman spent some time early last year looking into an effort to remove some dams in Massachusetts. We've got 3,000 plus dams.
Yes,
and he filed a story with Sound from the demolition of a dam on Trap Hole Brook in Norwood. This is Beth Lambert, who's the director of the state's Division of Ecological Restoration.
The sound of the hydraulic hammer, to me, is one of the best sounds in the world. When you hear that hammer, you know that another dam is coming down and the river will recover its health.
And yet some communities don't want to lose their dams. It's part of their identity with industrial heritage and their contributions maybe in textile making, for example.
Exactly.
And so even here, you use Stellwagen Bank National Marine Reserve as an example. Let's come right here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
How do we have those conversations?
The conversation, so this is part of the thing that I talk about with some of my colleagues who do this kind of work and with folks in the federal government is that a lot of people think that, and this is part of the class that John Honey and I teach, this class that has the terribly long name, is that folks will think that something like a benefit cost analysis is an objective, mathematical, scientific, clear yes or no answer. But as is the case with anything you do, the closer you get to it, the weirder it becomes. And it's a way to find out what's happening, right? So how do you connect with the local communities to make sure that you are actually representing their perspective? And you're doing that fairly and in the same way that you would with anybody else, right? So John and I taught a class, we still teach it sometimes, but it started out being about the dams on the Shawshene River, right? Mm-hmm. So that flows into the Merrimack, right? And initially, students taking the class would say, oh, well, we got to take these dams out, right? They're blocking herring movement, and we got to restore nature, and dams are messing with that. And the truth is, there's a lot of folks because, like, when Europeans came to Massachusetts, you know, took a little while to get that settled, but, like, hydropower ran the Industrial Revolution. That's the reason we have towns like Lowell and like Worcester, right? So, like, that's a huge part of the history of the Commonwealth. And so
a historical society, for example, might
exactly.
Like that.
That's exactly right. So the historical society would point out, like, hey, these dams are heritage. This is the industrial heritage of these towns, right? And other folks would say, well, the dams create a pool upstream, which is a really nice place to go fishing, or it's a really nice place for our kids to go canoeing. And you can't, in a democracy anyway, you can't just say, absolutely not. We're just going to prioritize nature over everything, right? I mean, I might feel that way, but that's not a legitimate policy approach, right?
Yeah.
So there's that, and there's also the fact that some of these remnant dams actually can be sort of fixed up and used to generate local hydropower, which we've seen in Vermont.
So much, much more complicated, and I'm assuming that's what your students get out of the class.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Najim Rahim is an associate professor of economics and interim chair of the Department of Marketing Communication at Emerson College. The course in this brilliant Boston that we're talking about is Motivating Pro-Environmental Behavior to Save the World. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.